This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 7:04. I'm Melissa Ingalls. Groups helping Wisconsinites access abortion say they're preparing for the possibility of the procedure becoming illegal in the state if the U.S. Supreme Court overturns Roe v. Wade. Hope Kerwin has more.
For 30 years, Cheryl Thede and the other volunteers at Options Fund in Eau Claire have helped people in northwestern Wisconsin access abortions. With no providers in their region, Thede said people have to travel to Milwaukee or Madison or cities in neighboring Minnesota.
We're talking about travel costs, possibly child care costs, a day off of work. And then because of the 24-hour waiting period in Wisconsin, there's also two trips. So the cost and the barriers really begin to rise.
Thede says those financial barriers and the stigma around abortion will only get worse if the procedure becomes illegal in the state. She says her group is working with other abortion funds in the region and national advocacy groups to prepare for that possibility. That includes looking into grants for legal assistance to make sure their volunteer organization is protected. Hope Kerwin, Wisconsin Public Radio.
The former state Supreme Court justice leading a Republican investigation of the 2020 election has a new contract with the Wisconsin Assembly. As Sean Johnson reports, the latest agreement has no firm expiration date.
The new deal between Assembly Speaker Robin Voss and Special Counsel Michael Gableman isn't scheduled to end until all of the outside lawsuits connected to Gableman's case are complete. Gableman is currently fighting multiple open records lawsuits in Dane County. Another Dane County case challenges his subpoena authority. And a Waukesha County lawsuit filed by Gableman threatens to jail people who don't comply with his subpoenas. The contract also states that either Gableman or Voss could terminate the deal by providing written notice to the other party. Gableman's latest agreement will pay him $5,500 per month on top of a monthly rent payment of $2,500. He was originally paid $11,000 per month on a deal that was scheduled to expire last October. Sean Johnson, Wisconsin Public Radio.
A 12-year-old girl whose neck was knelt on by an off-duty Kenosha police officer during a fight in her school will, along with her father, sue the officer and other authorities. The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reports the claim says the girl suffered a traumatic brain injury in the incident. The notice of claim also says the Kenosha County District Attorney's Office has charged the girl for her part in the altercation. Jarrell Perez, the girl's father, is one of the claimants, along with his daughter, who is identified as Jane Doe. Off-duty Kenosha police officer Sean Gutschow was breaking up a fight when he pushed the girl to the ground and placed her in a chokehold restraint by kneeling on her neck for more than 20 seconds. Gutschow is named in the notice along with Chief of Police Eric Larson, the City of Kenosha, and Kenosha Unified School District. Governor Tony Evers banned the use of chokeholds by Wisconsin law enforcement in June. The north will be partly sunny with a chance of mainly afternoon thunderstorms. Some could be severe. Central and northeast Wisconsin could get some morning thunderstorms followed by sunny skies. And it'll be sunny in the south, highs mostly in the upper 80s to low 90s.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Progressive Insurance, home of the Name Your Price tool, so drivers can see coverage options at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law. And the listeners who support this NPR station.
COVID cases are rising again. So are hospitalizations, so are deaths. It is time to check in with our state's chief medical. Ryan Westergaard is here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Our nation will reach that bleak milestone in the coming days, the 1 millionth recorded COVID death. Join in with questions on vaccines, on boosters, therapeutics, variants, masking. Bring it on, 800-642-1234. Dr. Ryan Westergaard, Chief Medical Officer and State Epidemiologist for Communicable Diseases for the Wisconsin Department of Health Services. Welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. Nice to speak with you again.
Well, here we are. More than 60% of Wisconsinites fully vaccinated, but boosters really lagging. When you look at all the numbers, how do you feel about where we're at this point?
Well, we're in a significantly worse situation than we were about a month ago. At the end of March, our numbers were lower. We were having about 200 cases per day test positive in the state. That was a real victory compared to a couple of months before that when we had the devastating Omicron wave with thousands and thousands of cases per day. But since late March, things have gradually increased. And you know, this week, we've had a couple of days with 2,000 cases or more. And as you mentioned, that we have more people in the hospital than we had been. So it's, an upswing, but not nearly as dramatic as we'd suffered during the winter, but something that we need to pay attention to.
As you look at this upswing, what is going on here? What is causing this rise?
It's the virus changing, mostly. People, for the most part, have gotten back to their normal lives. Most people are immune to the virus in some way, either through vaccination or through having recovered from a previous infection. So we're not as vulnerable to severe disease as we were before. But at the same time that we as a community or as a species, if you will, have gotten stronger in fighting against the coronavirus has evolved to spread more and more easily. And that was the reason that the Omicron wave was so devastating, was because it spread in the air over long distances and caused much more rapid spread in communities. And since that time, we've had even more transmissible variants, what we call sub-variants of Omicron. So as time goes on, the virus figures out how to do its job, which is to infect people and spread from person to person ever more efficiently, even as we've learned ways to fight against it with treatments and vaccines.
Is that Omicron sub-variant circulating here in Wisconsin? And what are you seeing?
Yes, the original Omicron variant, the genotype that took over the whole world in December, January, and then tapered off in February, really is nowhere to be found now. What we're seeing is all of its descendants. So the BA2 variant and the BA112.
Let me see if you got it. Yeah. When I saw that, I was like, I'm not going there. Too many numbers.
No problem.
But so you are seeing that circulating here in Wisconsin?
Yeah. No, so those are very much the new variants are the ones that are taking over for sure.
Pfizer and Moderna testing updated vaccines that are targeting Omicron as well as the original COVID strain. What do you say to someone who is skeptical a booster will work to protect them against these new variants and the sub-variants?
Vaccination remains the best strategy for preventing hospitalizations and severe disease. So the science is very clear. We recommend everyone be up to date on their vaccines. We expect the vaccines will continue to evolve in the coming years as the virus does, but it's always going to be our number one line of defense against preventing severe disease.
Talking with Dr. Ryan Westergaard, Chief Medical Officer, State Epidemiologist for Communicable Diseases with DHS. You can join in all your COVID questions, 800-642-1234. So what effect does warmer weather, really warm weather, have on the pandemic spread as more people venture outside?
I think it's hard to know. Okay. You know, we have, we're most respiratory illnesses, they get better when the weather gets warmer. Flu season is the fall and the winter, as we know, cold and flu season. We haven't seen that the coronavirus has had that kind of pattern yet. It's more sporadic. So clearly when people gather in large numbers, that's a risk factor for super spreading events. We've seen holidays trigger upticks in the virus, spring break, for example. But in general, we've seen large waves of new disease around the world in hot summer months as well as the cold winter months. So I don't think it's settled into a pattern that we can predict reliably yet.
With the rise of at-home testing, government sending out at-home tests, rapid tests, how relevant, accurate are the state's numbers, given that, you know, people may experience, get a positive rapid test and not report it and stay home?
Yeah, it's a really good question. So our approach to surveillance or monitoring what the disease is doing in the communities has changed over time. And I think even despite the issue that you mentioned that people are doing tests at home, our system's actually better in some ways than it was in 2021. We've got a number of different parameters. All the tests that happen in healthcare settings, positive and negative, still get reported. And that gives us a great ability to see trends over time. And secondly, we have a new framework from CDC to look not only at how many positive cases there are, but how many people are in hospitals, because as the virus is now everywhere, we want to focus more on preventing severe disease. And thirdly, we have new technologies such as wastewater surveillance, which can actually give a pretty good window into how much virus is spreading in the communities. So we have these different perspectives that we can take, and we can have a pretty good sense on how hot the fire is burning or what the epidemic is doing in different areas of the country by looking at these different streams of data. And we don't need to count every single positive test. We still have a good idea.
But the labs have been really, I would imagine, really helpful to you, those lab tests, to see what is circulating here in Wisconsin. How do you feel about testing turnaround time for PCRs and just what the labs are offering with their testing infrastructure at this point?
Yeah, the laboratory-based tests are always going to be a really critical component. And we have enough capacity through our clinical laboratories, our hospital-based laboratories, and some of the large research laboratories to do exactly what you said, which is when we test people positive with those PCR tests, which are the molecular tests that really detect the virus genes directly, it has the added benefit of telling us what variants or what types of the virus are circulating. And we don't need to do that at a large proportion. We don't need to do 100% of tests to have a good idea. What we do is sampling. So if we sample 10, 20% of the circulating virus, and we do it in a consistent and systematic way, we can have a really good idea of, are we starting to see the surge of the new variant that's coming? And that's how we know and keep awareness of what the epidemic is doing on that molecular level.
Turnaround time for PCR tests, is it still around 2 days, maybe less, maybe more?
Yeah, it depends. There's laboratories that are embedded in hospitals will have a turnaround time of a couple of hours. Mm. And then some areas where the tests have to get shipped overnight, sometimes to a lab out of state, it could take a couple of days. But in general, compared to, say, 2 years ago, when we were just building our laboratory capacity, turnaround time is much, much better. So yes, yeah, so the days of needing to wait 5 to 7 days for a turnaround for a test are behind us. It can always be better. These are still complex tests, and there's certainly a role for new tests and rapid tests. But the standard, you know, the workhorse test of the PCR still is going to take a day or two.
Wisconsin's Chief Medical Officer, Dr. Ryan Westergaard, with us, giving us an update on COVID in our state, fielding questions coming up for you on battling the disease, on vaccines, on boosters, therapeutics. We'll talk more about masking, testing. You can join in 800-642-1234. We'll pick this up in a moment with Dr. Westergaard here on the Ideas Network. Wisconsin is seeing an uptick in COVID cases and reported hospitalizations and deaths. And this as vaccine uptake hits new lows. We get an update on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. State Health Department announced earlier this month that oral antiviral medications for the treatment of COVID are now widely available at Wisconsin pharmacies. Join in with your questions about antivirals, about vaccines, about boosters, masking, more. 800-642-1234. DHS Chief Medical Officer Dr. Ryan Westergaard with us for about 9 more minutes. Let's go to Chuck in Plainfield. Chuck, hi. What's on your mind?
Hi. I was wondering, if you get Johnson & Johnson, then you get a booster for Johnson & Johnson, then if you switch it, Moderna, that is not quite a booster then, because it's the first time. Is that correct?
Chuck, thank you. Dr. Westergaard.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, thanks, Chuck. I think the first thing to know is, as people who have gotten the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, certainly had some protection, but as the more that we've learned, the protection wasn't as strong as the mRNA vaccines, the one, like you said, Moderna or Pfizer. So the CDC has recommended people that originally got Moderna to get an additional dose with the mRNA vaccine and to complete their, as you say, their booster series. So it is a pretty complicated grid on what we call a booster, what we call a second dose. But people that did get Johnson & Johnson first, when they're due for a booster, our recommendation is to get either the Pfizer or Moderna. So being up to date now these days means getting a booster, and we prefer the Moderna or Pfizer in this country.
Chuck, does that make sense?
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Sure. Thank you, Chuck. Let's talk a little more about boosters. In March, the FDA authorized a second booster of the Pfizer or the Moderna vaccines for older people and immunocompromised individuals. Should everyone expect to need another booster in the coming months?
I think that's a reasonable explanation or expectation. What we've learned about immunity from COVID-19, whether it comes from recovering from an infection or from a vaccine, is that it's pretty good for the first few months and then it starts to wane. And this is science that's very much in progress. We don't know what the final schedule of vaccination is going to yet be, whether it eventually will be an every year schedule like we have for influenza. But as we've been looking at the data in real time, it seems like after 5 to 6 months, the level of antibodies goes down. And when we see people in large population-based studies, the risk of getting infected and getting hospitalized tends to climb back up after those 5 to 6 months. So that was the recommendation for the original booster doses. Mm-hmm. And then when we looked at the data further out yet, it does seem that some people would benefit from an additional dose. So we have to wait and see what the studies tell us. But the message, even though the science is getting complicated, the message is simple, which is, consult the website or talk to your healthcare professional to make sure that you're up to date, whatever that means for you. And if you're older or have an immunocompromising condition, now that's two boosters, so a total of four doses.
What are you hearing about the availability of a COVID vaccine for children 5 and under?
Yeah, it's still under study. And if people may recall hearing in the news a few months ago that there was an application submitted to FDA for broadening the authorization for the youngest age group, and the data just weren't there. We have pretty high standards, very high standards for authorizing or approving new vaccines to make sure that there's a clear signal that they are beneficial and that they are safe. And because younger children don't have as high risk of severe disease, it's going to take a longer time to be extra sure that the benefit in those younger age groups is worth recommending a vaccine. There really was not a safety concern. It wasn't that it seems dangerous or that there were a high rate of adverse effects in younger group. It was really just more difficult in that younger age group to demonstrate that it prevents severe outcomes. So the effect may be smaller, and the recommendation will come when the science community and the federal regulators are convinced after looking at the data that this is going to do good on balance.
Okay, so exercise patience there. Let's bring in Kaylee in Waukesha. Kaylee, hi.
Yes. Hello. Good morning. I was calling because I am currently 8 months pregnant and I recently had my second booster shot of the Pfizer. And my question is, when I do give birth, in a little bit here, how long, if I intend to breastfeed my baby, how long will those benefits of the boosters and subsequent shots that I've already received be beneficial to my child, if they will at all, through breast milk?
Yeah, those are great questions. So I think we've got good science saying that the benefit is real, that breastfeeding, that even just having birth being immune, you transfer some of that immune system protection to the baby. So that is great news that the baby will have antibodies, be born with antibodies to the SARS-CoV-2 virus. How long that lasts, we don't really know. It's been demonstrated that the antibodies are present, which is good, but not probably enough studies to say how long it's going to last. But I think this message to people who are expecting children is that protecting yourself and everyone in your family, to keep everyone in your family safe, is a great thing. So everyone being up to date on their vaccines keeps the whole family safe. And congratulations.
Oh, yes, Kaylee, thank you for the call and best wishes. Let's go to James now in Phelps. James, hi.
Hello.
Hi, what's on your mind?
Well, I'd just like to ask the gentleman there why there is no discussion of the adverse reactions to the shots. All I ever hear about is how good they are. But yet, when you talk about the adverse reactions only being reported in less than 1% of the people, the DOD and the military now is being chastised by their own doctors because women that are pregnant in the military have 40% more issues with their babies after being delivered. And that includes all different kinds of deformities.
Okay, James, let's hear from Dr. Westergaard on that. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I think it's a good question. And I'd say that when you the way that we measure adverse effects from vaccines is number one through the clinical trials, when people are given either a placebo or a dummy injection versus the real vaccine, and we see how often they report some side effects or some adverse effects, and the rate of adverse side effects in the studies was actually pretty high, but they were mild. So 30, 40, sometimes even more percent of people are going to report that they don't feel great after getting the COVID-19 vaccine. So the side effects are real, but they last a day or two and they're generally not severe. So on balance, what I mentioned before, when we make recommendations on whether people should get a vaccine or not, we balance both the risk of these side effects that are relatively minor to the benefits of preventing severe disease. And as Kate mentioned at the beginning, we're coming up to a point where 1 million people have died in the United States from COVID-19. So there's a tremendous risk of severe disease. Balancing that against relatively mild side effects from vaccines, you know, the judgment in the medical community and the public health community is that for everybody, that benefits outweigh the risks, and that's why we feel comfortable recommending them.
James, thanks. Louie now in Oconto. Louie, you're on with Dr. Ryan Westergaard, Chief Medical Officer with DHS.
Dr. Westergaard, my question is this. I understand that the Paxlovid is now available because they increased the risk factors for people who contact COVID. Can you talk about that? And also, there's a few people that shouldn't get the Paxlovid because of their health conditions, and they should get something other than that. Just talk about if you contact the COVID virus and what the person should take.
Great. Yeah. Louie, I'm glad we're getting to this. Go ahead, Dr. Westergaard.
Yes, I agree. This is one of the big messages that we want to get out these days, is that, you know, the treatments now, Paxlovid is an oral medication, so a set of pills for 5 days, that when they studied it, reduced the risk of severe disease and death by 90%. So that's a pretty good track record. Initially, it was in short supply, but these days we've gotten more and more out to pharmacies all around the state. So we want both healthcare professionals and patients to know that it's available. And when people test positive, starting Paxlovid or one of the other medications soon after diagnosis can really be beneficial in terms of making the symptoms go away faster and preventing the need to go into the hospital. So it is a bit of a complicated medication, and there can be interactions with some other medications that people might take. And so it's been a little bit slow to develop the systems and the checks to make sure that it's the right drug for everyone. And there's really no substitute for talking with a healthcare professional to get advice to make sure it doesn't interact with other medications that you're taking. But in general, it's a really important tool, one that I hope that we use more and more going into the fall, because we'll be able to prevent a lot of bad outcomes.
Well, Dr. Westergaard, we're almost out of time, but what has DHS learned through these times, through pandemic times, that it can take forward here?
Well, we've learned how to move into an all-of-government approach to respond to a really large public health emergency. Mm-hmm. And you know, the big benchmark that I think we feel really, really satisfied and really proud about is 10 million doses of vaccine administered. And that seems that's a very large number in a very short amount of time. And behind the scenes, I think the teams that were involved in the planning, the distribution, the troubleshooting, and the coordination just deserve a lot of credit. So I'm very grateful to everyone in the state health department, in our local tribal health departments, and our healthcare organizations who've made that happen. We've saved a lot of lives by getting vaccines out to people in an efficient way.
And Doctor,
we have a lot to be proud about.
Dr. Westergaard, thank you for joining us.
Yep, thanks for having me.
Dr. Ryan Westergaard, Chief Medical Officer, State Epidemiologist. News is next on the Ideas Network. We're discussing the latest approaches to containing the invasive ash tree killing insect, the emerald ash borer, here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. First confirmed sighting in Eau Claire County was back at the end of 2017. Ashland County was the new detection last month, bringing the total to 64 counties. That's according to tracking by the State Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection. Join in on the approach your community is taking with ash trees, with attempts to contain the invasive beetle. 800-642-1234. Matthew Stauenmeier is forestry supervisor for the city of Eau Claire. Matt, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you.
Good morning. So since 2013, your city has removed nearly 7,000 ash trees to control for emerald ash. Is that strategy working to contain the infestation of the ash-killing beetle?
It's not so much of a containment strategy as it is kind of a diversification strategy for our community. Back in the 70s and 80s and 90s and actually into the early 2000s, Dutch elm disease was very rampant in our community, and through that process, ash trees were replacing a lot of the elm trees. So we had a high population of ash, and now, you know, what we're seeing is having an invasive species like emerald ash borer coming and attacking one particular species. We have a lot of potential risk, I guess you would say. And so this is a more of a diversification strategy than just an eradication strategy.
You know, what is the impact of that on your resources to take down that many trees? How expensive is it for Eau Claire to try to contain this? And what are the implications to the tree canopy?
Well, I think the cost of it is something that can be broken into a few different categories. You know, like there are treatment options, and those can be cost effective, but they're kind of long-term solutions. So it would be kind of ad infinitum that you would need to treat, or at least until, you know, emerald ash borer has been, you know, basically through your area and is no longer so much of a threat, kind of like what Dutch elm disease has done, you know, just kind of naturalized. With the budgets that we have that are somewhat fixed, we decided to do kind of a unique situation where I was able to use community block grant monies to buy trees and then take down ash trees and use those removals as vacancies for planting new diverse species. That way we're building resilience into our program into the future by having a whole lot of different species. And really the goal is to get, you know, the species to be, you know, down to about 10% at the most, or at least the genus to be at least 10%. Right now, ash trees, when we started, it was at about 34% of the population, which is, you know, just an amazing amount. It's basically turning the community into a monoculture.
What have you planted to replace them?
Oh, goodness. Right now, we're planting about 75 different varieties. So the broad topics that we plant are, you know, we actually do plant elm again, some hybridized elms that are disease resistant. Oaks, we plant quite a few different varieties of oak, linden, honey locust, hackberry, ginkgo, katsura, Kentucky coffee, you know, amarmachia. I've really been trying to plant things that are a little bit more unique. And then when we get into ornamental trees, it gets even nicer, you know, redbud, you know, obviously crabapple to a limited extent.
So it sounds like you really focus on tree diversity now after going through Dutch elm and what's happened with ash trees.
Absolutely. And I think that's the one lesson that, you know, needs to be kind of learned, is that reliance on one or two species that may really work in our area is really opening us up for a pretty significant opportunity for, you know, a disease or a pest to come in and really impact our communities, you know, devastatingly.
You mentioned these long-term treatment options. These are the insecticides you can you know, apply to the ash trees. They're the trunk sprays and the injections. How well do those insecticides work to save the tree?
The efficacy of those are very good if you started treating well before any sort of signs or symptoms of infestation. Many of them are prophylactic treatments, at least the over-the-counter varieties. You know, like if you go to a box store or a nursery or wherever and you know, get, you know, certain imidacloprid types of preparations or whatever. Homeowners can do those, you know, to an extent. But if you want really, you know, significant protection and or therapeutic, those are the injectables and some of the more professional grade chemicals. And the efficacy of those, you know, depending upon the chemical, some of them are multiple year coverage. But it is good to have redundancy. So, you know, like making sure that once you do start the treatment process that you stay on it. Mm. Because any lapse in that, this is a very voracious insect. You know, it'll go after healthy trees just as much as it'll go after stressed trees or sickly trees. So it really plays no favorites. So if you are going to treat your trees, the best time to treat them is probably 3 years ago, and to continue it, you know, for the next, you know, until you don't want the tree any longer. So
we're talking with Eau Claire Forestry Supervisor Matt Stoudenmeyer about how to contain the invasive emerald ash borer. You can join in with your questions, 800-642-1234. Kevin is joining us from Janesville with a question. Hi, Kevin. Go ahead.
Hi, good morning. Quick comment. Janesville went through the same kind of thing back in the 50s with our elm tree population. Dutch elm wiped everything out. And again, we're seeing ash trees take a huge hit. And kudos on the diversification, smartly. Has any thought given to food-producing trees, fruit trees, nut trees that people could harvest, the city could collect, sell, donate to food pantries, use the plants for a dual purpose? I'll take any comment off the air.
Thanks, Kevin, thank you. Yes, Matt.
Yeah, that gets to a really cool question. We do have certain parks or parklets, I guess you would say, edible garden spaces in the city that we do have fruit trees and other forageable varieties. But by and large, we try not to plant a whole lot of trees that produce significant fruit, just because sometimes the fruit can become a nuisance. And the problem with sometimes planting on boulevards or in front of houses is that a homeowner may just love that tree, you know, for the time being that they live there. But then they sell the house and the new owner comes and is, you know, just appalled by the mess, or just sees it as a liability, or whatever the case might be. And so you have these things that, depending on the timeline almost, you know, like can really be a perspective shift. So by eliminating trees that have tremendous amounts of nuisance fruit or, you know, other or, you know, kind of characteristics that might be seen as nuisance, limiting those plantings really is kind of a strategic thought too. So planting them in parks or planting them in community spaces that, you know, like it's not so much of an issue is one thing, but in front of people's houses on the boulevard sometimes is a little bit touchy.
Kevin, thanks for the call. How, Matt, can a person recognize the beetle's presence in their ash tree?
Well, that's a good question. mostly what you'll see is kind of a secondary characteristic from woodpeckers trying to eat the larvae of the beetle. And the larvae are actually the thing, the mechanism that kills the trees. Because as they feed, they disrupt the vascular system of the tree. So sometimes you'll see just kind of blanched or patches of bark that have been sloughed off, you know, and usually it's from the woodpeckers kind of working and their claws kind of clawing the surface of the bark off.
Mm-hmm.
So it'll look almost kind of blondish or, you know. The other thing is if you do start to see actual bark falling off of the tree, that's pretty you know, like pretty far down the infestation. Sometimes you'll see like those, what they'd call like epicormic sprouts, you know, or adventitious sprouts on the tree, the little water sprout type of things, you know, like when you see those, usually the sign of stress on the tree. But more often than not, seeing the woodpeckers and the woodpecker damage, that's pretty much
sign.
A strong indication. Yep.
I've always wondered, why does this emerald ash borer only do its business in ash trees? Why aren't other types of trees susceptible?
I think it's just a species-specific insect. I don't really have a clear, definitive reason why this agrillis beetle is, you know, like so specific to ash trees. But for whatever reason, it just finds those to be the cat's meow. And where it came from in China, the ash trees there have somewhat of a naturalized mechanism to limit their population. But here, there's really no natural limiting factors. So we're kind of left to this widespread infestation.
Emerald ash borer, the cat's meow, ash trees. Matt Stoudenmeyer is Eau Claire's forestry supervisor, helping us as we look at how Wisconsin communities are trying to stop these infestations of the emerald ash borer. Join in with your questions about ash trees, this beetle from Asia, what your community has done with containment. 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're exploring how communities around our state are treating or removing ash trees affected by the spread of the invasive beetle, the emerald ash borer. Beetle was first confirmed in our state in 2008. That's approaching a quarter century ago. Can you believe that? What is the ash tree plan like where you live? Still time to join in with questions. 800-642-1234. Matt Stoudenmeyer is forestry supervisor for the city of Eau Claire with us for about 10 more minutes. So, Matt, take us into the how your city approaches taking down ash trees. If a tree needs to be removed because of the emerald ash borer, does the city or the property owner take the lead on that? And who pays for that?
Well, that's another good question. we basically, as the city, only remove trees that are within the city's right-of-ways or in public spaces, parks, you know, city hall, you know, different city-owned properties. if a tree is in a private homeowner's yard or something like that, it would be on their responsibility to take the tree down. Generally speaking, we started going kind of through neighborhoods just to kind of make it a little bit more succinct for our crew, so they could just kind of concentrate on a neighborhood, and then we could replant that neighborhood kind of in time. It was a volunteer or a voluntary program, so we would ask people to opt in, and we wouldn't really do anything with their tree if they didn't suggest that they wanted something done. So it wasn't like the city's coming in the middle of the night and cutting people's trees or, anything of that sort. This was totally a volunteer-based process where we could, you know, kind of put out information and give people options and then hopefully educate the community while we're doing that so it doesn't come as quite a shock. The secondary issue is that once the beetle was discovered in 17.
For you, 17, for, yes, yeah, in your county.
December-ish of 17. people were wondering, like, what are you guys going to do? You know, like, what is the city going to do? And, you know, we were, you know, actually in a pretty good position because we'd already been doing it. Our management strategy had already been working, and so we had already reduced the population of ash trees in public spaces by, quite a considerable margin. and also diversified with new plantings. So having that plan and working the plan really has put us into a pretty decent position. Now, there's still quite a few trees left on, you know, the boulevards and in public spaces that need to be dealt with, but not nearly as many as when we started.
What advice do you give communities such as Ashland County, which has just detected it, as they go forward, or other communities around you as they try to address this issue? What is your best advice?
I think from a municipal forestry standpoint, getting community buy-in, getting and continuing to have the trust of the community so that they feel like they have a say in how it's being managed. Also with the replanting, I think that's another key, you know, part of this equation. Is cutting trees down is one thing, but putting something back, I think, is the more crucial aspect. You know, having an idea as to, you know, like what you want to see in the future for your canopy. If you plant the three types of trees that seem to work the best, you're probably going to run into another situation down the road. I think everybody in the state is kind of holding their breath about something that would be particularly fond of maple trees, just because there's so many maple trees in cities and throughout the state. So having a plan that involves diversification with planting afterward, mm-hmm. I think is really important.
So buy-in from the community, diversifying the replantings. And now that the emerald ash borer has been found in basically almost every county of our state, 64, can we eradicate it? Is that even possible?
Eradication was never really on the table, mm-hmm. Just because it is such a fast-spreading organism. Dutch elm disease and some of these other things that have a little slower pace, you know, like might be able to be contained, you know, geographically. But since this is an insect that actually can fly quite easily and pretty far, it's very hard to contain. You know, like this was first discovered in, you know, the Detroit area of Michigan, almost 20 years ago now. And, you know, it has spread just rapidly throughout the Midwest. And, you know, I think it's even in Colorado and other places, you know, throughout the United States. So it's not really so much that it can be eradicated. But I think it's something that needs to be looked at as long-term managed and more or less like naturalized. There is some research going on with remainder trees. Those would be ash trees that just seem to continue to live even after they've been attacked by emerald ash borer for whatever reason. It's kind of a interesting topic, you know, in itself, similar to how, you know, like when Dutch elm disease came through, there would be, say, 100 elm trees that all died of Dutch elm disease, and there would be that one lone tree that seemingly fought it off.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, propagating cuttings from that tree because it maybe has some sort of natural resistance to the insect, that might be something in the future to kind of keep these species still, you know, part of the palette of trees that we can, you know, kind of use in our communities.
That also might inform why you're able to have elm now back into the mix, that you're looking at a you know, that you're planting ones that are not going to fall again to Dutch elm disease.
Right. And it's not that they can't, it's just that they're a little bit more resistant to it. So, you know, all things considered, nothing is perfect, I don't think. But more often than not, you try to find things that, you know, can survive, you know, well in these harsh conditions, you know, because really most trees that are in the city are totally unnatural trees. They were planted, you know, they didn't just, live there for the last 400 years. So we have to find things that can tolerate the conditions that we're planting the trees in.
Let's go to Mark in Belleville, who is an arborist, Mark, I understand.
Good morning. Yes,
good morning.
I'm an arborist and I'm a landscape architect as well. But yeah, I just wanted to applaud the work that you're doing there and just reiterate how hard this has been. And I in my career have been working on these things as well. And there's constantly new pests out there, and just, you know, we have this emerald ash borer going through the state, and Michigan's been decimated, as well as many other Midwestern states. But the thing is, there's another bug coming now. It's spotted lanternfly that we need to keep our eyes out for. The thing is, you just don't know how much they're going to impact the trees and things. And then I really applaud the diversity comment, and that people really need to be careful about what they use that's not also an invasive species tree, because that also brings its own problems.
But. Mark, thank you so much for that call. Matt, we're short on time here, but what are you watching for in terms of other invasives?
That is very true. You know, like spotted lanternfly, dadcap is really actively, sending out information about the potential of that insect coming to our locations. a lot of the other invasive things that we struggle with are your run-of-the-mill plant invasives, you know, buckthorn, honeysuckle, spotted knapweed, you know, the other plants that just seem to get away. And like Mark had mentioned, you know, being mindful of the tree species or the plant species that you're planting in your yard, just because of that invasive capacity. Trees and so forth are on a little bit different timeline than
mm-hmm.
we are.
Mm-hmm.
So they can start doing stuff, you know, many years down the road that you don't even really notice. And suddenly they're everywhere.
Matt,
so that's a good point.
Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. This was great.
Matt Stoudenmeyer, Forestry Supervisor for the City of Eau Claire. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.